Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. This is show number 300. Yes, it's been 6 years since we've been doing this. And my guest this week is Dennis Moody, who happens to have been the very first guest on this podcast, as well as, I think, on just about every year since then. And we'll talk more about that more. But first of all, streaming growth has been slowing. Yeah, it was a gangbuster year last year for streaming in the United States. The year-end report from Alpha Data, which is what Rolling Stone uses to power their charts, says that there is just a tad over 1 trillion streams in the U.S. That's 1 trillion music streams. That was up 25% from the year before, which sounds really great. The only thing is, the previous 4 or 5 years, the growth was about 40% or greater. So what we're finding here is that the growth is slowing. And that could be a little disconcerting, especially for some of the major record labels. Universal Music indicated that their revenue growth had decelerated a lot last year, and that's kind of scary. Even video streams, yes, they were up 10.6% last year, but in other years, the growth was much, much greater. For video, there were about 304 billion streams. So compare that to music, and you see that music is really going gangbusters these days. There are certain things that are not gangbusters. Album sales dropped below 100 million to about 93 million. That's a 23% decrease. Boy, it used to be that we'd blow past 100 million in no time during the year. And now it takes us a whole year and we don't even get there. Download sales also. There were 295 million, which is a lot more than I would have expected. That being said, it's down by 26%, and that looks like it's falling off a cliff. Vinyl was up 10% to about 10.7 million, but that's also decelerating. Other years have found the growth much, much higher than this. And if you look at vinyl, really, it's about 5 or 6% of the entire music business. It's not that great, regardless what those numbers are, and it looks kind of impressive, but it's not as good as you might think. So when it comes down to it, we're finding that everybody's happy in the music business. It's prospering. There is money. The budgets are higher. The executives have big smiles in their faces, but that may not last that much longer. I think we're still going to have growth here for a while, but it's not going to be the wild growth that we're seeing for these last 4 or 5 years after streaming sort of hit the mainstream. So it will be interesting to see exactly what happens this coming year. In 2020, I'm going to be watching the reports very closely just to see how this plays out. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget about my online courses on mixing, production, branding, and music business success at bobbyosinskicourses.com. Also, get an expert analysis and objective opinion of your songs and mixes as a member of my Hitmakers Club. Go to hitmakersclub.com to learn more. Now, here's something that's really interesting. UC Berkeley did a study of 2,500 random people in the United States and China. And what they wanted to find out is what kind of music triggers what kind of emotions. What they discovered was there were 13 emotions that music triggers. So how do they figure that out? If you take notice that China is a big part of this, and the reason why is they wanted to compare cultures and how music affects different cultures. And it turns out that it's very similar between them. So they played 40 different samples, and that includes everything from Ed Sheeran's Shape of You to George Michael's Careless Whispers, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, The Clash, Rock the Casbah, Al Green's Let's Stay Together, the shower scene from Psycho, and the movie score from Jaws. It was really varied. And they found that these 13 emotions were a result of listening to these examples. Here they are: amusement, joy, eroticism, beauty, relaxation, sadness, dreaminess, triumph, anxiety, scariness, annoyance, defiance, and feeling pumped up. I'd say that just about covers it. So then the researchers weren't satisfied. They went back and they did a second study just to verify everything. And this time they used 1,000 participants, but 300 different pieces of traditional music. So now they were comparing against the music of the particular culture. And you know what? They found out exactly the same thing. 13 musical emotions. So you might think about that because it might be an interesting way to write, writing around an emotion. Now, certainly that's sometimes the case when you're doing a movie score, television score, you're writing production music, you're writing for an emotion, but it might be interesting to write a pop song like that as well. My guest today in episode number 300 is Dennis Moody, who's the engineer of choice for some of the world's top drummers, including Dave Weckl, Steve Gadd, Vinnie Colaiuta, James Gadson, Dennis Chambers, Greg Bissonette, and many more. He's also one of the few studio engineers that also tours the world as a front-of-house engineer as well. Dennis was my first guest on my very first podcast back almost 6 years ago now. Since then, he's been the only guest to return more than twice, appearing on podcasts number 50, 100, 150, and 200. I like to check back every year with Dennis to get some updates in the world of audio since he travels the world so much. That said, I haven't had him on for a couple of years, so it was really good to catch up. During the interview, we spoke about the trends in audio, especially live sound, the economics of the touring business, using subwoofers, the search for the mic that works better than an SM58, and much more. I spoke with Dennis via Skype from his home in the high California desert. Tell me about the last 2 years in terms of the trends that you've been seeing. Trends in gear, trends in music.
Gear, it's getting more, I'm saying like live consoles are getting smaller, which I don't really like. I'm seeing a lot of that. They're getting cheaper and they're getting better. And, you know, it's hard for me because every time you go to a different club or a different venue, you got a different console. You have to learn all that stuff over and over. And then once you learn it, it's obsolete. So that's an issue that I don't really like about it. But they're throwing stuff out so fast. Music, I'm kind of, with my circle of clients and stuff, I'm still working with the same kind of people. The Jazz Fusions did a big show with Dave Weckl in St. Louis with his original band, which was quite a success. Went to Cuba with Dave Weckl's band. That was really nice. I'm not working with my Persian artists anymore, Gugush. They have new managers that wanted to try things differently. It wasn't the problem. They actually called me back, but I wasn't available. So that gig's over. But it was quite enjoying years, and I feel for them. They're having a lot of technical issues going on with their shows right now, but you know, they're trying to get it together, and I have plenty of other things to do. My clients, I've still done a lot of my studio the last couple months, but before that I was on the road so much, which is good and bad. It's nice to be busy, but when you're away, I mean, you know, you get just disconnected really quickly from your circle of clients and colleagues, you know.
Yeah. When you've been away, has it been for long periods of time?
Well, not really. The longest I was probably was 3 weeks out of this. But what happens is we'll leave Thursday, fly somewhere to the East Coast, do a show, fly somewhere the next day, do a show, fly somewhere the next day, do a show, fly back to LA. Next day, I will fly back to LA. Tuesday, I will spend prepping the next, just finalizing the preparation on the next week's gigs. I'll have Wednesday for myself, and then Thursday we do it again. So, you know, I came back and the last gig with Keiko Matsui, who I've been working with a lot last year, I came back about a 3-foot pile of paperwork on my desk that needed to be sorted out, and I was going, ugh, this is too much. So I'm catching up now, but the longest I was gone for maybe 3 weeks, and that's about enough now. But I mean, I'll take more if it's right. prefer the short ones. You know, a couple weekends a month is fine.
Last time I talked to you, you mentioned the fact that you were required to do dual jobs, not only mix, but also be the tour manager as well.
Yeah, we call it the professional babysitter. Yeah, it's, you know, I understand that's the way it is now, so I try and deal with it, but it's not what I do. I'm not a tour manager. I'm not a travel agent. I'm not a, you know, menu coordinator. And those are all jobs. Manager. And I found that if I wanted, you know, make it my way, okay, here's where we're eating tonight. And they go, why? We don't want to eat there. You know, we want to try something. And then or on the opposite side, if I say, hey, where do you guys want to eat? I get, you're the road manager. So it's never, you can't make anybody happy. You know, it's really hard. That's a special talent and that's not my thing. You know, I mix and I can set up the stage and I can prep the advance for the sound gear and even send out an equipment rider if I need to, but you know, it's not what I do. So, unfortunately we have to do a lot of it now and, it's a kind of an issue for me, but you know, I'm trying to get through it.
You mentioned before the consoles were getting smaller. Is that because they're of the layers? There's fewer faders and more layers?
Yeah. Yeah. So now most of the smaller clubs will have an M32, which is 16 faders per layer. And, They go up to 32 channel. Yeah, they're getting smaller because they want to be portable. If people can bring them, they'll start to. I mean, they are bringing their own consoles now, which I don't get, because you can get that console, you can run down to Guitar Center or somewhere and pick up one of those consoles, use it for your show, and return it the next day if you have to. Or you can rent one for very affordably. There's no need to. You put on a USB stick and that's your whole mix. So I don't understand the logic of that, but that's what they're doing. Now everybody's getting these consoles and you can pretty much find an M32 or an X32 Behringer about anywhere these days. And now the Yamaha CL5, which is my console of choice, is pretty much, I can find it anywhere, which is really nice. I really like that console. It gives 72 inputs. So when I'm doing these orchestra dates, it covers about half of the inputs I need.
You mentioned that they're getting better. Is that because of the processing or just the sound?
I think it's the design, the layout. You know, sonically, I was okay with the M7CL, which a lot of people think is not a great console. It's practical, easy to use. You can see all your faders on one page. And to me, it's not the gear, it's the ear. So sonically, the only consoles I won't name them here, but there's some consoles that are extremely popular that I go, how can they be? They don't sound that good, and they're extremely difficult. What they're doing is they're making the features are much more practical for what you would need. You have your access to your auxes, and you can do much more with grouping and such. You have more parameters, much more there, reverbs, all kinds of stuff they're giving you these days, which are making things much, much easier to mix. I mean, I could run 8 reverbs on the CL5, where I could only do 4 on the M7CL.
Let's talk about the demands for musicians. Has that changed at all?
Here's what I'm saying. When I advance a show, you know, the management will send out a rider with the back line on it, and I will call just to make sure they have it. And if they don't, what options they have. This is what I'm saying now with the touring club bands, let's say the smooth jazz bands and such. You get all your back line is given to you, and then in really small letters at the print at the bottom, it says from house backline supply. Okay, so these clubs now are going out, instead of renting a drum set for $400 a night, they're spending $2,000 and buying a drum set. Okay, so after 5 nights, it's paid for, and then they own it. And then they're buying two or three. They'll buy a DW, they'll buy a Yamaha, and they'll buy whatever the next most popular one is. They're doing it with bass rigs. You'll get two or three options. Guitar amps, you'll get two or three, a Marshall or a Fender. So musicians getting more demanding, they can get more demanding, but it's not possible. You know, I have to look at a contract when I'm talking to these the production managers at the venue, and I see what's permitted and what's going to be done. And then when the band comes and they go, "Hey, I don't like these cymbals," I go, "Well, we can get them. They're $200 for each night, and we're there three nights, and the artist isn't going to pay $600 for cymbals when they have an optional cymbal there that works." So they have to get more, they're getting more used to this fact, you know, that their options are going to be more limited now, unless you want to carry your stuff. You know, you can't fly an amp, an amplifier somewhere. It's too expensive these days, you know, so. Yeah.
Are you seeing any modeling amplifiers?
Yes, I saw the, with Edgar Winter, Doug, the guitarist, used Kemper. It's phenomenal. The first show we used it on was in Amsterdam, actually, and I just couldn't believe how great it sounded. But he was missing it. He couldn't get that back from the monitors. So what he did, I got the Kemper out front, and then he took an output, a Y output of it, and put a Marshall on stage, and it worked very well. They're really sounding great. They're really coming up with some really good stuff these days.
Kind of curious about if the acts that you're doing are still on floor monitors or in-ears.
It depends. Keiko Matsui, who was my main biggest client all year for touring, they're all on floor wedges. But then she has one wedge for her piano, and that's it. Goes on her left side. The drummer, Jimmy Branley, has one monitor, and then the bass player and guitar player are so close to each other on the stage, they split one monitor. There's no need to have two monitors. So they're all on floor wedges. Some of the bigger ones, Oingo Boingo, former members of Oingo Boingo that are still together and doing some great shows. We did quite a lot of shows last year. There, the lead singer's on ears. One of the guitarists is on ears. The drummer is on ears for some of it. So I think it's personal preference. I would love it if I could get everybody on ears. When I was working for the Persian singer Gugush, I really pushed to get any new member. I've said, "You're on ears. You don't have a choice. You're on ears." Because the stage level just gets so loud. You know, the drummer is very loud, great drummer, but very loud. And then the bass player would turn up to be louder enough, and then everybody would just be fighting each other. So I really enjoy it when they're all in ears, you know, but some of them just won't do it. So you have to put a wedge up for them, old school.
Okay, but that being said, when you're in small clubs, is there a monitor engineer, or are you doing both front of house and monitor?
Front house and monitor. Yep. Yeah, front house and monitor. Even some of the bigger places now are having that. I see guys doing big 1,000-seaters doing monitors. They set up the monitors from front of house, and then they work off of the iPads on stage. So even to me, I can't imagine that, but I've seen it. I see people doing it, and I just hope it's not the wave of the future. They just keep cutting people out, you know, and it's due to economics. Now with the iPad mixing capabilities and the iPhone mixing capabilities with the Yamaha monitor mix, and then Behringer and Midas have a really good one with their system, but again they're limited to 32 channels, so that's hard to get everybody, you know, with all the bands. A lot of the bands I do have much more more channel count than that. So
yeah, what are you seeing for line arrays?
Well, you have the L-Acoustic, which are very popular and sound phenomenal. And then you have the D&B, which are the top two. JBL Vertec is a really good one I see around, but mostly L-Acoustic and D&B. To me, I first was introduced to D&B when I was living in Europe. after I met you originally back in 1990 or 91 when we met. And then I went to Europe in 93. I was introduced to D&B, and they were a local, it was a German company. And I used those, and it was phenomenal. I noticed them immediately, could tell the difference in the quality. So I'm a big fan of D&B. Sometimes you get an off brand. I won't name them, but you know, you have to make it work, you know, but I get in when I'm doing a show, I'll just play a few pieces of music and listen on my iPod. I have a 4 or 5 tunes, one to hear where the bass low frequency and the subs are, one for the high frequency, and then one just for general music. So I can EQ it. Sometimes the EQ is pretty drastic, but that's to compensate for a different kind of loudspeaker. Each venue is of course different, but here's another thing. You could put a D&B rig in one venue and then put the same one in another, and they're going to sound completely different, you know? So you have to just kind of use your ear.
Does it have to do with the way the subwoofers are configured?
I'm not sure. And when I mix, I'm very light on the subs, and I ask them to please adjust the processor on the main boxes as low as they can go. And I don't push, you know, I'm not mixing techno and stuff like that. So when I'm doing jazz fusion or smooth jazz, even, I don't really, you know, I like them to get the mains down to about 60 if they can, and then I can get what I need out of that. I'm very light on the subs. I put a little bit of kick in there, a little bass. If there's some loops, that need low stuff, I'll put that in. But I don't know if it's just the acoustics of each room, you know, that vary. So it's hard to say. I go into every room with an open mind, and hopefully it's good. Some of them are really bad. Most of them are decent, and a lot are really great. So depends where you are.
Have you heard the L-Acoustics Elisa system by any chance, the immersive system?
I think I have, but I can't really, I mean, going to 3 or 4 venues every weekend, it's hard to keep track. You know, I just, okay, there's speakers, here's my console. Let's do this.
You would know with this because there's no less than 5 arrays across the front.
Oh, okay.
Usually more. It's a system very much like Dolby Atmos. Matter of fact, it is. It's the same thing. It's basically Atmos for live.
Huh.
The whole idea is if you run a stereo sound system, then you only have a small sweet spot in the audience. But with this, up to 95% of the audience can hear what you're doing as far as panning is concerned. And then you can also add up to 128 channels. So if you're in a venue, you know, you can do overheads and on the side and the rear and everything. It's what Aerosmith is using in Las Vegas during their residency.
That's interesting because the Sony Music Hall in New York City has that. And I did a few shows there a few months ago with Keiko Metsui and Randy Brecker. And then I can't remember the other one, but they offered it to me. They said, you want to use the Atmos? And I said, I don't want to experiment on her. They said, once I commit to it, I can't change it by pushing a button and go back to stereo fold down. So I didn't opt to use it. I think that needs a little more planning, but he said what they do is they take the stage plot and they configure the outputs according to the stage plot. So it gives you the feeling that you're sitting in the stage with the band. And it sounded interesting, but you know, when you have a band coming in town in the morning and people are expecting a certain quality of a show, and if it doesn't work or I'm not used to it or, you know, not setting it up properly for some reason, it could be a disaster. So I haven't opted to use it yet.
I went out to L Acoustics in Westlake. I didn't realize they have a very big facility out there. And they have one room where they have a 22-channel system set up. And it was made specifically to do your pre-production before you actually went out and ran into that situation. So basically, you can program everything up, put it on your stick, and then take it out, and then go.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
What console? I mean, do they have variable consoles, or is it?
There's only one. I don't recall what it was, to be honest with you, but pretty interesting, I have to say. I was really struck by how cool it was.
I thought about that back in the 90s when I was doing musicals, how that system like that could work, you know, but it hadn't been invented yet. So, see, I snoozed, I lost.
Yeah, well, I don't think the processing was there yet because it's all object-based when you're moving things around. And, you know, it does require, well, for today, it's not that big a deal with the computers that we have. But back then, it would have been a chore, I think.
That's true. Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet.
Yeah, there you go. Right, right.
That's pretty neat, though. I bet it would work great in musicals and shows, especially if you're in a fixed place for like a month. When I did Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, you know, we had this big orchestra, 94-piece orchestra, 60-piece choir, and then we had 16 leads on, wireless theater mics. And I think they're Sennheisers. I can't remember what we use, Sennheisers and DPAs. And I always thought how cool it would be if we could get some motion happening, you know, as the guy's walking across the stage. It would really add to it. But I think they're all doing that now.
I went down to downtown LA where there was a show using the ALIZA system. And it was like a off-Broadway show, about 200-seat theater or so, and it was a combination stage, show, video, holograms, all that stuff, all built into one. And so it was perfect for the type of immersive sound system that they had as well. The whole thing was very impressive, I have to say. It's one of those things where you didn't think about the audio because it was just so tied in really well with the other media.
Oh, yeah. It's great when that happens. And it does happen a lot, you know,
yeah.
But in a theatrical piece or a multimedia piece, I think it'd be much more efficient, you know?
Yeah.
Very cool.
Although I hear, you know, that there are a number of artists that are going out on tour with it. Geez, I think they said Ed Sheeran was one of them, although it doesn't seem like he has a big band, so it doesn't matter, but there were a few. Anyway, let's talk about the studio for a little bit.
Yes. Well, that's funny because I've been gone so much coming in and out, you know, things, a little few maintenance issues, like a switch will break. Okay, so I'll do a quick workaround so I can continue working, and then another switch will break or the air conditioner will go out, and no problem. It's winter now, so we don't need it. And I just finally, in November, I started with new air conditioners. You know, very quiet, very efficient, much more efficient than I had. I started getting little things fixed. I have a C3 Hammond in there someone gifted me, and the power switch is broken for 3 years. You know, I can't use this. All these little things, I made a list, and I just started working down on it. Like a handles on the sliding door, you know, were taped with gaffer tape. I fixed all that stuff. I had a M5 Avalon mic pre that was out for years, but I had other options, so I didn't bother with it. I got all that stuff fixed. I picked up some mics from an estate sale. I got some great mics, I got a 441, a couple 421s, KM84, two 460s, a 451, a D112, a great deal. Really great deal, probably a third of what they're worth, I think, maybe. But just adding to the mic collection, you know, I got a couple WA87s that I'm enjoying. So I have a nice mic collection going now to enhance what I already had. So more options that way. You know, I got a 441 too, which I love on acoustic basses, and being that I do a lot of jazz dates, it's a really great mic for that. So it's coming together. It's really coming together. I just hope I'm here a lot more in 2020 so I can actually enjoy it. It's a nice little studio. So
tell me about the WA87s, the Warm Audio. The reason why is, you know, I hear a lot about them. I haven't tried them myself, or at least not in a real environment. And the people I talk to about them, I'm not so sure how much I trust their judgment. you've been around enough and you know what the real thing sounds like and you know all the alternatives. So what's your opinion?
Well, in all fairness to them, you know, the mic is a fourth of the price of a real 87, if not less. So you're going to have different parts in it, you know. So it doesn't sound like a real 87 to me. It's a little harsher in the mid-range than a real 87 is. And I'm using a GML mic pre. So that's not affecting that at all. It's just a little harsher in the mids. And if you get a soft singer, okay, for example, if I put them on my acoustic piano, they sound awesome. They have just the right curve to make my piano just really sound great, phenomenal. But if I use them on a loud singer, I mean, a really loud, like R&B singer, they can peak out. I've had it happen a couple times. And, you know, when you have a singer in there, you can't have that. So it's a little bit concerning to me, but I do love them. I use them for softer singers. They have just that punch, just the perfect tone for them. And I've tried both of them to make sure it wasn't just one of them that was sounding like that. You know, I mean, Bryce over at Warm Audio is a great guy, and I've been friends with him since they first came out, and I'm really supportive of what they're doing, you know. But I have to know, in my opinion, you know, this is not a Neumann U87. This is a Warm Audio 87, and it's going to have a different characteristics. But I love it. I really, really like the way it's working for me.
You know, I found that too, where the less expensive alternatives, that tends to be a characteristic where they just cannot take the level.
No, they can't. And it was the first time I found that out was... it was not a good situation for it. I had a pretty well-known R&B disco singer from the 80s, late 70s, 80s, and she hit a note and it just went poof. I said, no, I can't have that. I know how to fix it, though. You know, I'm pretty good at getting rid of that stuff. I just went in and cut that poof noise. I just cut it 500 and below, and it kind of went away. I was able to mask it, so it worked fine. But, you know, you can't have that. And with a real Neumann, which would cost me $2,500 or more, I don't think I would have that issue. I think it would hold up a little more. And I'm not sure what the mid-range is. I can't remember when doing horn dates in other studios like a Sunset Sound or Paramount or something. I know that 87 is going to – I know how it's going to sound. It's not going to have that bump at 3K that this one has.
Is there something that you're looking to buy?
Yes. Actually, yes. I want to get the Neumann U67 reissue. And I hear from everybody. I mean, when we go to our audio lunches with Peter Doyle over there on Wednesday afternoons, I was talking to Al Schmidt about it. And he said, oh, my. And I said, hey, what do you think of this? He goes, it sounds just like the old days. You know, they did a great job on it. Of course, even there, I think there's going to be some differences. But to buy a new one, you know, it's going to be all original. It's going to be intact. You know, you have no idea. Someone offered me a Telefunken 67 recently for less money than a new. And I go, that's impossible. But turned out that the diaphragm had been replaced, not original. One of the tubes had been replaced. You know, you pay that kind of money, it sounds great, but it's not a Neumann. You know, once you change the diaphragm in the tube, you've kind of lost it. It's something else, you know.
Speaking of Telefunken, I was at the factory in Connecticut. I was basically at a conference in Connecticut, and they had a barbecue at the Telefunken factory afterwards. I was amazed at how big an operation it is. I mean, really big. I just had no idea they were shipping that number of microphones. And really, they were across the board, you know, their most expensive ones down to the least expensive ones. They were going out the door at a rate like you wouldn't believe.
You know, they all kind of came out at the same time trying to compete with each other. And they're both great. They're all great mics. Sure love having a C12 now.
Yeah. Do you run into any of their live microphones at all?
Telefunken? No, I haven't. What is that, the M88?
I think it is. Do you see the Neumann one?
Well, here's the yes. I have one client who's a great jazz singer, and she has a Neumann, was the 105, and it picks up everything. I had to put a 58 on her after, because we're picking up, it's feeding back, you know, and when you're in a club, it was a Blue Note Hawaii, Honolulu, and it was just feeding back, you know, the way the speakers are configured, I can't use one. And when I was with Babyface, we tried one, and the whole, you know, you could turn off the band. The whole thing's coming through the vocal mic. They sound great, but you better have a singer that just really consistently belts, you know, otherwise you get, so your signal to noise is rejected, you know, you can get, the whole band comes through it. So I do love the way they sound, but I would probably opt for a 58 because I know how they sound after doing this for decades, and I know what to expect, you know, out of it with all those issues, feedback and proximity and all that. I know exactly what to do with that.
Have you found a microphone better than a 58?
That's funny. I heard one, but I don't remember what it was. It was some kind of Sennheiser. And remember the Music Machine over in West LA?
Sure.
Back in the 80s and 90s, they had a mic there. And I had one singer who was extremely dynamic. And when he'd go low notes, it got really muddy. And when he'd go high, it would be shrieking. And this mic had no reaction to that. It just sounded great at all levels. And I go, what mic is that? And I've tried to find out. And I've actually tried some Sennheisers that I thought might be it. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the one. But I can't remember what it was. But no, 58 to me always works. And if you get a Beta 58 or 58A, they're too bright for me. They're too sibilant. Just saw a show downtown at the one, I don't know if it was the Orpheum or somewhere, as a band, an Irish folk band called the Water Boys. And I know their drummer well. So I went down there and I couldn't believe the sibilance that was coming off the guy's mic, you know. And I asked my friend Ralph after the show, what kind of vocal mic was he using? Oh, he's using a Beta 58. A, I think, or Beta A to 7A, and that's the wrong mic for him. It's just too bright. It's just cutting your ears off, you know, and then you have to DS it, so just get the right mic. Originally, yes, I think there might be some out there, but I don't know what they are.
Mm, okay.
One of these days, I'll find it, though.
Everybody's trying to replace the 58, but so far, no one's really come out with the killer.
No. No, and it's going to be hard for them to do that because everybody's ear is used to it. You know, the people who go to shows, they're used to it. You know, they know that sound. Even if they don't, they know that's what it sounds like. So I'd be curious to see, you know, everybody has a new idea. You know, what do they say? Anyway, yeah, it's interesting to see what's going to happen.
Besides what we talked about before, what do you see that's changing in the business?
What do I see in this whole business?
Yeah.
Economics. They're finding that they can get away with doing less, and they're doing less, even if they don't need to do less. And to me, it makes the people working the show, the production crews, have to work much harder and take on much more responsibility, but they aren't being compensated for that. You know, I don't see people, you know, like the road manager, sound guy thing. You know, they don't pay us extra for that. It's just part of the pay. And so I think in the entire business, economics, and now everybody has a studio at home. Everybody has, you know, or they have access to a friend who does. They just aren't spending the money they used to. They just aren't spending the money. And I it's kind of sad because I don't want to get into specifics because I don't want to look like I'm talking bad about people, but there's some shows I've done where they've actually cut the money so bad that it's the shows have crashed out, you know, more than once, you know, and they're consistently crashing out, but yet they aren't doing anything because the managers won't spend the money.
You know, the funny part about that is I think the music business has come late to that, or at least the touring side of the business has come late, where we've seen this happen in other businesses where half of the employees would be let go and everybody that was left would have two or three jobs to do for the same amount of money, which has been kind of the norm for a while. And now we're seeing it in your end as well.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. And like flying, you know, I say I'm a United one, was 1K with United for years and years in a row, which means you are their top clients. Now I'm 6.5 feet tall. So people go, well, what's the big deal? Just go on the plane and fly there. They don't understand the planes are getting smaller and the seats are getting smaller and smaller. So it's a really important for me to maintain my status on there so I can at least get economy plus, you know, given to me gratis when I book a flight, you know. Some of them are refusing to book me on. They said, no, you have to go with everybody else and you have to fly in Delta or American and it's just too much expense, or, and it's really a problem. This year I didn't make it even to the lowest level. I had to do some creative financing stuff a couple weeks ago to be able to make sure that I maintain my at least my lowest status is going to allow me to have those things like Star Alliance Gold. And again, people don't think that's important, but if you're going to LAX every weekend and flying somewhere and you're doing, you know, 100 flights every year or more, it's very important to have those kind of things, you know. But when it comes to money, they just won't pay it, you know.
I don't do nearly as much flying as you do, but I do a lot. And it's really important to me. And I go out of my way to maintain that status, even if it costs me more money, because in the long run, I know I'm going to be happier.
Sure.
Flying is not fun. I don't know that it ever was, but it's worse than it's ever been. So you might as well be comfortable, or as comfortable as you can be.
Yeah. And they keep changing the requirements to qualify for any of that. Like I said, I didn't make it this year. So I had to go spend a bunch of money on my credit card to hit a waiver level where I could do it. And I just did it barely. But, you know, yeah, it's difficult. It is difficult. But it's not fun.
Yeah, okay. The economics. You know, the funny thing is the big studios are still busy. And in many cases, they actually have multi-month bookings, which didn't happen for the longest time. And of course, we're talking bigger acts that have the budget that they can do it. I guess we're talking about the 1%, really, but the studios are the 1% anyway that I'm talking about. We thought for a while that they weren't going to last, but apparently there's a demand for it. But, you know, everybody in the middle, that's a tough business to be in.
I'm in the middle. I might even be on the lower end of it because I don't have outside engineers coming into my place. I mean, they're welcome, but I've only had a couple, you know, but it, you know, here's my studio. If a band wants to come in for a couple of days, you know, they can come in for 3 days and record 8 hours a day and it's going to be under $2,000, you know? I mean, that's a very reasonable rate. And that's why I'm managing to keep busy, because I didn't price myself out of the lower range people. I mean, they want to come in and cut a track in 4 hours of studio, it costs them $300, you know, and they could come in and that's not outrageous at all. You know, then they come in and I have all the headphones, I have all the mics, I have the space. So I'm lucky that I'm able to compete and stay busy, even though I'm mostly cutting tracks for people who will take it home and do their post-production and then bring it back to me to mix, usually, or they'll mix it themselves.
Oh, they're asking you to mix as well? That's great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm doing a lot of mixing and I'm doing a lot of editing, a lot of mixing, and a lot of mastering lately, too. You know, I was using Eddie, and now that he's not doing it, you know, with Oasis, I said, wait a minute, I can do this. I sat next to the kings of the business, you know, Fred John Golden, Ken Perry, you know, Bernie Grundman. I sat next to those guys, you know, for years and watched what they were doing. I go, wait, I can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So I started doing it, and I just, if some one of my clients wants to, I just charge them the rate, you know, that I'm doing for recording the record and mixing it, and making sure that the product at the end comes out how I'm hearing it. You know, it's been working for me.
You can find out more about Dennis at DennisMoody.com. Dennis Moody, MOODY.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to the episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.